There's two. Okay. Repeat after me. Yadajnanat abhudvaitam. Yadajnanat abhudvaitam. Nyate yasmin nivartate.
Nyate yasmin nivartate.
Rajusarpavaratyantam.
Rajusarpavaratyantam.
Tam vande purushottamam.
Tam vande purushottamam.
Yad ajnanat abhut dvaitam nyate yasmin nivartate. Raju sarpavat atyantam tam vande purushottamam. Tam vande purushottamam. I salute, I prostrate to him, that one, that purushottama, to that supreme. Before it was Paramatma, now it's Purushottama. Purushottama means the person, that being who is Uttama. Again, the most exalted, the most supreme. Another name for the Atma, for yourself, your being, which is infinite, which is Brahman. Brahman means the whole tradition of Vedanta. All of the Upanishads really have one, what they call tatparya, one essential vision that they're revealing to the student. And that vision is called the Mahavakya. The Mahavakya is just a statement of identity. An example of a Mahavakya would be tet tvam asi, you are that. That's a statement of identity. Your being, and what if I were to break it down just a little bit, your being, the self that you are, the Atma, the conscious being that you are, is Brahman, is infinite, is the self which is the infinite non-dual self of the whole creation. Brahman means that the conscious being which is by nature infinite. So you take this self that you are to be limited by the body, mind, sense organs. This body, mind, sense organs complex is me, whereas in actuality, this conscious being that you are is infinite in the non-dual self of the entire creation. So that's the equation. This you, until you have knowledge, take yourself to be limited, but in fact, this self that you've taken to be limited is in fact non-dual, infinite being. So you, the Atma, this Atma is the word for this, the self. Of course, I take myself to be this body, mind, sense organs, but this Atma, this self is Brahman, is the one who is infinite. Infinite means one without a second. Infinite, there's no such thing as infinite plus one. Infinite plus one is still infinite. Infinite minus one is still infinite. So if your nature, if you are infinite, there really isn't room for anything else, because that would limit the infinite. See what I mean? You're infinite, but then there's all of these other things. No, if you're infinite, there is no other thing. So the whole teaching of the Upanishads can be boiled down to this essential Mahavakya. Another one is exactly the same. There's four major Mahavakyas. They all say the same thing. In other words, Aham Brahmasmi. Aham Asmi, I am Brahman. That's put in the first person, and we use that more for meditation. You know, you are that, is the teacher is going to unfold to you that you are, in fact, infinite Brahman. If I say it in the first person, I am that Brahman, or Prajnanam Brahman, Prajnanam Chaitanyam, you know, the Brahman that I am is pure consciousness. So there's I am Atma Brahman, this Atma is Brahman. So every Upanishad will have a Mahavakya. And so they're just quoting like four Mahavakyas, one for each Veda, one for the Veda is the Indian, the Vedic scripture, and there are four of them that all have the same message. So each Mahavakya represents one Upanishad that is found in one of the Vedas, of these four major Mahavakyas. The Mahavakya is really the vision that the Upanishad and the teacher-student relationship, that guru-sisha. Guru means the teacher, the one who removes ignorance. It's called the guru. Guru isn't just somebody walking around. You don't walk around as a guru. You're only a guru to your student. The student is called the sishya. So the sishya, if the sishya recognizes you as their teacher in terms of the vision of Advaita Vedanta, the one who removes that ajnana, that ignorance, and that person becomes your guru, right? So the Upanishad, all the Upanishads, really are a dialogue, a guru-sisha dialogue, where the student comes to the teacher and asks, you know, the who am I question, who am I really, is there anything about me that survives death, is there anything about me that is beyond these pairs of opposites, of sukha dukkha, pleasure pain, pleasure pain, pleasure pain, you know, happiness, sadness. Is there anything about me that survives and is free of all of this, and is not subject to this birth and death? So in the Hindu tradition, when a person starts having that question, they will approach a teacher. And that becomes a serious question for you, not just kind of a passing, oh, what an interesting question. Let's go on and do our thing. When it becomes a primary question, then the student will approach a teacher and ask to be taught. Yeah. And then this guru-sisha dialogue begins. So in this here, let's see, what word just triggered all of that? So my salutations to that Purushottaman. Again, Purusha, so the Purusha means person, but that person who is really Uttama is not to be better than the person who is Brahman, who is infinite. So in the whole teaching tradition, it's the recognition that this innermost being, this me, innermost being, not some being hiding deeply inside. Innermost being means the me, the me that I can't objectify. I can objectify my thoughts, my moods and my feelings. Like if I ask you, what are you thinking right now? Well, I was thinking this. How are you feeling? Well, I'm feeling this way. And when you're feeling another way, now I'm feeling this way. First I was thinking this, then I was thinking this. That's objectifying. You can even objectify the I thought. You say, I am doing this, I am feeling this, I am wanting this. This word I is also objectified. What isn't objectified is that is the innermost me, which you can no longer, you get down to the core of yourself. You can't objectify it, because then who's objectifying it? Then that's the self. The objectifying means to be aware of as a subject-object relationship. But in the end, your own being is self-shining as the conscious me, the consciousness which is me. So it doesn't need to be objectified, because you are consciousness. But if you could objectify yourself, then we want to know, who is that one? Because of whom this self is aware. So when you get to who you actually are, you are never going to be somebody who's an object or a feeling or a sensation or a perception in time and space that is coming and going, because when it goes, you'd be gone then. I just think, I'm my thought and it's going to go. And that would be scary, wouldn't it? I am my thought, it's going to go, I can't hang on to it, I only have a second to live. But we never have that experience. We have the experience always of experience itself as something objectifiable, coming and going. And I remain as the conscious being, right? Who is always left behind. Right? I never go when the thought or the mood or the emotion or the perception goes. I always remain. So now that being so, if the thoughts or the feelings can go and I always remain here, then I should be able to differentiate the one who remains from that which goes. It's really that simple. Because, I mean, the simplicity is so astounding that it's hard for us. You know. Swamiji even once said, when I first met Swamiji in India, he was taking us down along the Ganga on a walk. There must have been about 20 of us. So here we were marching along the Ganga on a walk, and Swamiji was showing us all of Rishikesh, which at that time, where his ashram was, it was just fields along the river. So beautiful. Now it's totally overgrown with a town, but in the 70s it was very pristine, and he had his little kutir, and there were a few other kutirs here and there, but, you know, his kutir was just very clean, surrounded by fields, meadows. And so he's taking us on this nice walk down this kind of dirt path to a place where different swamis were living in their huts. and where there was going to be a big bonfire. He wanted some, for some reason, some celebration. There was a big bonfire. So he took us there. And I still remember we all sat around the bonfire. And I said something to I asked him a question, because I had just been new, had recently come there. And I was so excited and starting to understand what Swamiji was talking about. And for some reason, honestly, not really even knowing the profundity of what I was saying. You know, we can say something and it's actually very, very profound or very, very true, but you don't know how true it is until 10 years later. So I just said, Swamiji, this is actually really simple, isn't it? And then he looked and he said, It is so simple that we have to unwind so many conceptual, conclusions to get down to that level of simplicity. It's so simple that it's difficult. It's like another thing he'll say around that, that yourself is hidden in the seeker. Another way of saying that, to make it even more clear, yourself is the seeker. The very self of the seeker is the self that needs to be revealed. And so that means I'm hidden in the seeker, or I wouldn't be seeking. I wouldn't be looking for wholeness or fullness or the freedom of my own nature. I wouldn't be looking for it if I had recognized that this me, this self, that the mind so heavily identifies with, and the mind identifies with the body, right? And so therefore I become this limited being, that the true nature of my being that has been taken on by your mind to belong to itself is absolutely, absolutely free, is the Purushottama, is limitless by nature. You have never not been. Never not been means this me, not the thoughts that are continually going, not the experiences that are continually changing, but this me that I am, that is most intimate to me as me, that this me that you are has never not been. That means that right now, here, from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense, organs, we're experiencing this world, this time, all of these relationships. But if I went back a million years, it is this very me, or a billion years, or a trillion years, it is this very me, this timeless me, that is the self of whatever upadhi. Upadhi means conditioning adjunct. Whatever body happens to be present at that time, whatever mind, whatever thought happens to be present at that time, whatever world happens to be present at that time, the nature of that world, it is this me that is here right now that is there then, because the me that is here right now is not bound by time. No, I'm not bound by time because I can't be objectified as an object to exist within time and space. It's one of the objects. Anything within time and space, that's what we mean objectified. It's within time and space. There's a thing that it is not. It's bound by space. It's bound by time. It comes into being. It goes out of being. Just like we know the universe is like that. The universe is continually changing. Everything that we know, continually changing. We don't have any illusions about this body going on forever. We have never experienced a body that goes on forever. We only experience bodies that are born and that die. Bodies that are subject to change and old age and death and disease, etc. they take birth, jayate, they exist, vardate, then esti, then vardate, they grow, then parinamate, they go through puberty and go through transformation, and then, akshiyate, they vinashyate, they get old and they die. All things that take birth go through this process. They're born, they exist, they grow, decay, they die. And human and beings, living beings, jivas go through a maturation. In their teens, they go through some maturation. And from there, it's a downhill slope. Go through your maturation, you're fully blossomed, and from that point on, it's just a slow down. So like this. So everything is like that. Everything that exists within the creation, even plants, all living things, all things are subject to this process of change. And we know that. Even your mind, you can't even trust your mind. Your mind is happy now, but you know, when's that going to change? That's why Swamiji says something about the mind, the nature of your experience. It's a very unfortunate thing, but how it goes is, when you're really happy, those beautiful moments of happiness, fullness, completeness, those moments you feel a little sadness underneath, because you know it's not going to last. So even though there's that joy there, there's a sadness that underlies the joy, because you know the finite nature of that joy, right? So that's the happiness is tinged by sadness. And when you're down, so here's the up, here's the happiness, and here's the down, here's the depression, and the hurt, and the worry, you know, the pain. And when you're down here, the feeling is not that, oh, this will only last for a little while. It's, this is not going to go away. I'm not sure this is going to go away. So the down has so much worry that it will not go. And the up has worry because we know it will go. You know, we should have, it should be the, it's the same for both, actually. That's an important thing to realize. The up will go, the down will go. You know. And also we don't feel like it's even. People don't feel that it's even, that we have as many ups as we have downs. We don't have as many we don't have as many perfect moments as we have imperfect moments, but like that. So when Swamiji talks about the what we call the samsara, the ever changing world that we find ourselves in, that I find myself in, he uses the words sukha and dukkha. So these are beautiful words. Sukha, ka means space. So sukha means good space. That's the word we use for happiness. I'm in a good space. I thought that's nice that we actually have sukha, because we say that. I'm in a good space. Dukkha, dur. Dukkha, bad space. So when Swamiji talks about samsara, he'll go like this. It goes like this. Sukha, dukkha, 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 sukha, dukkha, 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 sukha, dukkha, 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 dukkha. That's the samsara that we find ourselves in. And the reason we find ourselves in that is really because of self-ignorance. So here, it says, my salutations to that Purushottama. Purushottama is the my own being, which is Brahman, which is infinite non-dual conscious being, the self of this whole creation, which is really myself. So salutations to that Purushottama. Then he says, when known, yasmin yate, dvaita, the duality, all duality, which includes all of the sukha dukkha, it includes all of the change, the very nature of this creation. It says when that self is known, nyate means is known. So yasmin nyate, when that self is known, dvaita yed ajnana abhut, dvaita, which is there because of ignorance of that self, yed, of which self? So because of ignorance of myself, ignorance of this self, which is limitless, this me, which in fact is limitless, because of ignorance, that dvaita is there. But when the self is known, it is that dvaita, that duality, which is a product of ignorance, that disappears, that duality disappears. It's a really amazing thing, because that duality has to be false. Otherwise, if the duality is real, then all of your suffering is real also. You say this duality is not real, it is mithya. And so when the truth of all of this experience is known, the duality itself goes away. And he gives an example. It goes away, not just goes a little bit away, atyantam, it goes away completely. Leaving nothing. Leaving nothing. Atyanta means absolutely, completely, it goes away. Rajasarpavad, like a rope, like a snake on a rope. Raju means rope. Sarpa means snake. So just like a snake on a rope. You know the snake rope snake story? Two boys are walking along at dusk, and one boy goes, and he sees a snake, and he feels himself pricked on his leg. And he goes and he rolls on the ground and says, I've just been bit by a snake, you know. And he feels that he fears he's going to die. Because there's in India, there are a lot of poisonous snakes. There's a lot of cobras. I've seen many of them, actually. Several. Many means two or three. To me, that's many. I've seen two or three cobras in India. Nobody sees a cobra, so three is a lot. So he is so frightened, and he's rolling on the ground. He knows he only has a few moments to live. Because he saw the snake, and he felt himself bitten. And his friend was with him. And his friend didn't see a snake. He said, I didn't see a snake. And he looks back, and his friend sees this rope that is about an inch and a half or 2 inches in diameter and has three or four bends. And he sees a little bit of the twine coming out one end of it. And he said, you weren't bitten, he feels confident, as you were not bitten by a snake. Honestly, it's only a rope. It's only a rope, he tells this boy. And the boy thinks he's crazy. He saw the snake. He felt the bite. No, I was bit. I was bit. I saw the snake. And also, all his emotions, all of his feelings, his reality now is snake. That's his reality. Snake bite is his reality. He saw it. He's positive. And the boy says, come, trust me. I promise you. I promise you it was not a snake. Come here. Come with me. And he makes this boy, drags him over, and he said, look at that. And he makes the boy look at this rope. And the boy sees the rope, same place, same position, same size, same three bends. He sees the little twigs, you know, the twine, and looks around and looks down at his leg where he had the big bite, nothing there, you know. And then he's starting to feel a little shy about the whole thing. And feeling, because he's looking at a snake. If he's looking at the snake, which is not a snake, he now sees that that snake actually was only a rope. It was only a rope. And now his whole buddhi, his whole mind, is no longer snake reality. Right? It's rope reality. The snake is reduced, you know, to mithya, the snake that he experienced. It had, in fact, never been there. It had never been anything. Let me put it this way. It had never been anything but the rope. Right? And so all of the emotional trauma, all of the problems that were generated by the snake no longer exist because the snake doesn't exist. Right? So those problems just vanish in thin air, you know, like the snake did. But what's interesting here is that it would have been very hard to convince that boy that it was not a snake until he saw the truth of the snake as the rope. It's not going to help him to think, to say, okay, I believe you, I believe that snake was only a rope. Belief is really not strong enough because he'll say, I believe it, but still, I have a doubt. You know, even in the religions of the world where the nature of the soul, that the soul goes to heaven or hell and all of these things, which are prevalent in the West and also around the world. But if what the religion has to teach is something that is to be realized later, like, for instance, salvation, to be realized later, to come face to face with the divine, to be realized later, not now, to be realized after death. These religions of the world will say and accept as part of their theology that doubt is a part of your faith. Doubt is a part of faith. So whatever it is, whether it's within the Vedanta or within any religion of the world, if it's something that cannot be, that you cannot gain direct, immediate knowledge of it, you must accept that though you have that belief and that belief is firm, it will be accompanied by doubt. And why that's so important to understand, especially... Oh, I know what I did. I set a little alarm because I don't want to have to stop talking and always check the... check, but I thought we were starting at 5, so I set it for 6. 1 minute, please. So it went and interrupted me anyway, improperly. Okay. This is a very important thing to understand because priests and really highly religious people were feeling very guilty about themselves because they were doubting their religion or they were doubting their faith, not realizing that the human mind, that doubt goes along with faith. Doubt is a part of faith. That's very, in the theology, different theology, it's very, very accepted now. It's important to know that doubt will be there unless you can have absolute knowledge, direct, immediate knowledge of something. And when you have direct, immediate knowledge of something where your mind totally comprehends, understands, and directly sees, then there is no doubt. In fact, with our means of knowledge that we have available to us, we operate doubt-free all of the time. You know, like for instance, if you're following, if you're confidently, talking about myself, walking up the steps, you know, you have to be able to see those steps, you know, and be able to just, you naturally walk up them. You don't say, is that a step? Or how high is that? Should I go up these? You know, are these real or not? It sounds silly, right? It sounds silly because our pramanas, our means of knowledge, give us clarity and that allows us to act. There is no doubt. But say you're going to go up those steps, you know, and then you're thinking in your mind, are those really steps? Are those steps strong enough to hold me? Are those the steps that I should be walking up or should I be going somewhere else? See what I mean? Then your mind is not knowing. It has no clarity, and so when that's the case, it can't make a decision to just proceed. We're always proceeding based upon our knowledge, our doubt-free knowledge. When there's doubt, we're not proceeding. Another example, more traditional example that we use all the time with this is Swamiji uses. You know, sometimes if you leave the house and you think, did we lock the door? I'm not sure. I have to go up, check, and then lock it if it's not locked. Right? Because I don't know. On the other hand, if I said, did I lock the door? Yeah, I locked it. Boom, I'm gone. Or the thought never occurs. I lock the door, I have no doubt, I'm gone. If I could get down to the bottom of the steps, I have a doubt. It freezes me, I have to think about it, I have to go back and recheck, you know. I had one client who had an obsessive compulsive disorder, very difficult to deal with. Her disorder was every time she started to leave the house, she'd think, did I turn off the burner? And then she would not know. And she would go back and check all the burners. Everything was fine. Then she would get out the door and she'd have the same thought, did I turn off that burner? Did I remember that burner? And she would have to go back into very, very difficult to break. This is doubt. Obsessive compulsive disorder has a lot to do with doubt. Your mind makes a decision or it has a knowledge, but then it can't hold it. And it wonders and it worries about it. You know, so there is such a thing. The point here is there is such a thing as knowledge. When you know something, when you have clarity, right, then the doubt doesn't come. So you have actually, by your knowledge, resolved the doubt, right? So that doubt is gone. And so now here, why this verse is so very important, is that what has to, if the truth of the Advaita Vedanta, of the Upanishads, is that you are free by your nature. Your nature is free. In fact, the being that you are is the self, this very intimate me that I take to be me right now, though I add all this baggage onto it, but it's this me that we're talking to, that this me is in fact free, you know, and is in fact the very self of all beings, and is the very self of the Lord, you know, the very self of all that is. And in fact, all that is really nothing but a mitya manifestation of my being. If that's a belief, it's not really helpful. It's a nice belief. Belief can have some be somewhat helpful, but it won't free you, because it will always be accompanied by doubt. And so the Upanishads are not about giving you a very beautiful belief, even though that can be helpful. It can give some relief, but it does that. Well, that's not the same as knowledge. Knowledge means you know who you are, and all of your behavior and all of your life acts off of that principle of knowledge. It's not always being attacked by doubt. But for that to take place, you do need to have knowledge, and that knowledge has to be such, you know, that it is doubt-free. And for your knowledge to be doubt-free, your mind has to clearly know. The guru may be doubt, teacher may be doubt-free, but that's not really going to help you. It can give you shraddha and trust. Shraddha means, it's a very important word, shraddha means you listen to this teaching, somehow it resonates deeply as being true. You have some God-given, we say God-given shraddha in the teaching and in the teacher, that he or she knows, seems to know what they're talking about, seems to be a sane person, not some crazy crackpot, some sane person who seems to have a grasp on this knowledge, who seems to be able to make me see. This knowledge feels, it touches me deeply. I feel the truth of it even though I don't know. I intuit enough that allows me to sit with this teaching and go through that process of unfoldment until I myself know exactly what the teacher knows. And so they call this shraddha. Shraddha, Swamiji translates sometimes as faith pending understanding. It's not faith until I die and go and see for myself. You know? It's faith pending knowledge that allows me to listen and to be available to see. Because the Upanishad's intent, it's not at all to give you a belief or to give you indirect knowledge, because yourself is here. And how can I even consider having indirect knowledge of me, the one who is present right now? So I have to have direct, immediate understanding and recognition of the freedom of my own being and the mityatva, you know, the dependent nature of this creation, that it has no substance apart from me. I have to be able to fully see that, and I have to be able to use my intellect fully to question. You should never be afraid of my mind or think that, you know, moksha or liberation means I have to shut down my mind because the mind can never understand. And so the mind is useless. I have to have a meditative experience. So no. You can have many meditative experiences and you still will have doubt because you don't really know what that meditative experience is. You know that maybe many of you have had different deep, profound meditative experiences, and then I did too, and especially when I was younger. And I would say to myself, I know that's true. I know that's the truth. No doubt, I have no doubt. But I don't know what that truth is. I know it is true. Yeah. I know, once I even had kind of a little vision that said there is only one. Just a little vision. There is only one. the words went through kind of in big letters. It's like kind of an emotional thing. There is only one, and I knew that was true. But I didn't know what it meant. I knew it was true. But contextually, what does it mean? What does it mean that I am only one? You know? Or if I have an experience of just pure conscious being, I come back from that experience, and then I think, how can I have that again? I need to have that again. That's what, that's me. I need to find that. Where is it? How to get back? So I have the experience, but the same ignorance. When I come back from the experience, the same ignorance is there. So it's like this dangling carrot. It's actually kind of important. It's like a beacon light or something that makes you know there's something, but you still need to reach it. But you can't reach it through taking a path. You have to reach it through removing the ajnanam, the ignorance that keeps the mind, the ignorance that the mind has of your very being, which is already completely present. And so what this verse, so this is, of course, all of these verses are important. So he says, salutations to that Purushottama, when known, that Dvaita, this whole duality, subject-object duality, seer-seeing duality, the duality of all this multiplicity, the duality of time and space, all of this is removed. Nivartate, all of this removed means disappears, atyantam, completely, just like the snake on a rope. Okay, so salutations to that supreme self. Okay, now, the snake and the rope can be a problem because you'll say, Swamiji sometimes makes fun of this, laughs about it. Do you mean I'm going to disappear like the snake? Are you all ready to disappear like the snake, just like that? You say, no, tomorrow would be fine, not now. So I don't think I want this knowledge right now if the whole universe is going to disappear. I'll do it later. It's a nice idea. It's a nice idea, but I'm not ready to disappear. So here, how could it be, really, in terms of this world, what does it mean that all Dvaita disappears? Because just even in our experience, there are two types of knowledge, actually, if I can talk about the effects of knowledge, of gaining knowledge. One has to do, like with the rope snake, with subjective projections, right? And so if I see a snake on a rope, mistake a rope for a snake, and now I'm just relating to the snake, when I gain knowledge of the rope, that snake, which was my subjective projection, will go away immediately, won't even be experienced, right? But when I gain knowledge of an objective perception. Now, objective perception means that that perception isn't subjective. It's not because of me. It's called vyavaharika. It's an empirical, shared perception, like of this couch, of this person, of this room, of all of us. This is shared perception, right? So it has, it's not created out of my subjectivity. It's not the illusion of my mind. If it's an illusion of my mind, it will go away. If it's not when I gain knowledge. But if it's not an illusion of my mind, if it enjoys the same order of reality of this body, mind, sense organs, then when I gain knowledge of it, right, it remains, but its stature changes. Its order of reality changes because I see something else. Right? It's the same like if I hold up to you the clay pot, I can see only concentrating on the pot. I'm relating only to the form. But when it's pointed out to me, when the clay is pointing out to me, I'm seeing another order of reality in reference to the pot. So with the pot that I respond to is one order of reality, and it is there, and it is being experienced by you. That order of reality is that it's beautiful, it's shaped in such and such a way, it's fragile, it can be broken, it can die. Okay? The order of reality of the clay is different. The clay can be in many forms. It could be in shards, it could be in pieces. It can be in the form of another, it can be in the form of another pot. You know? It is not subject to the same order of reality that the pot is subject to. The clay withstands change. Just in reference to the limitations of this illustration, the clay withstands change. The clay withstands birth and death. For instance, if I have the pot, if it's a wet clay, I've got a ball of clay, I make it into a pot. So I don't like that pot. That pot's dead. Okay, we just killed the pot. I'm going to make another pot. I make it into another form, maybe a tumbler. I say, let's make a plate. Psh, make a plate. Okay. So now these forms are coming into being and going out of being. Really. There is no more tumbler. The first pot is long gone. It does not exist anymore, truly. But nothing at all has happened to the clay. So even by looking just within Vyavahara empirical reality, I'm seeing two different orders of reality at the same time. Okay? In terms of rope snake and its applicability to us here in our world, I am seeing two orders of reality at the same time, but it's a different type of seeing. One is the seeing, the object, the seeing which has to do with the objectification of all of my changing experiences. Those are seen. This room is seen. All of you are seen. Seen means heard. I can smell. I can taste. I can hear. I can feel. I feel. And I can see. So I'm just using one sense organ here. I can see all of this world and experience its continual change and continual birth and death and coming into being and going out of being. I'm experiencing that right now, firsthand, directly, immediately. I'm experiencing change and birth and death. Okay. In reference to my mind, I experience my mind. I'm aware of my mind. I'm experiencing all of the thoughts and all of the moods and all of the emotions. I'm experiencing continually change. In fact, I experience it so thoroughly that I know that I can't control it very well. The mind is not really meant to be controlled. You know, it depends on what you mean by control. So you say, okay, I'm not going to think anymore. Stop. It'll try. It's like to holding your breath. It will win in the end. You know, or you say, I'm only going to have these kind of feelings, only feelings on the positive spectrum, nothing on the negative spectrum. Mm-hmm. From this point on, that's it. And the mind will just laugh at you. They'll laugh. It's like saying, "I don't think of a potato." No potato. Don't think of a potato. You try now. Try not to think of one. Susan, be potato, potato, potato. The mind's very tricky like that. Okay. So you're experiencing this world of change, both externally through your sense perception and internally through your mind, through your psyche, all of the things that it throws up, you know. Think about the mind like this. Also, through your sense perception, you are taking in so much data every moment, way more than your mind can handle. So it goes through a filtering system into the unconscious. Data is pouring in. It has to pour in through a filtering system so that you can just keep what is necessary at this moment to respond to, but so much is pouring in. And what comes in will come out, you know, at odd times, for no reason. Yeah. But you're taking in so, so much, it just goes into the unconscious because it needs to be stored somewhere. And then it will come out in this form or that form or this form. This is why one time Swamiji said, why do you bother about your thoughts? I have so many funny thoughts. They're just thoughts. Let them go. You know, you take the ones you want. It's called shama. We'll get into that later. But why do you worry? Why do you worry about the thoughts that are coming up? You have no control over a thought that rises, because then you would have to go into your unconscious and have a little talk with it and say, now, all you thoughts that are in there, Don't you come up without my permission. And right now I'm telling you I don't give you any permission. No permission. You stay down there. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So the mind, the Swamiji says, there's all kinds of funny things. If you don't like the thought, then just let it go. It will go. Just leave it alone. You know? Or smile. Say, okay, it's okay. You have some weird thought, it's okay. You know? We have to have that freedom that we don't have, actually. So all of this perceptual world that we have, which we know continually coming into being, continually going out of being, continually changing, you know, that is our direct, immediate experience. But also, our direct, immediate experience, though unidentified, is the nature of me, the one who is present to all of these experiences. We don't usually think like that, because the one who is present to all of the experiences is always identified with the mind as the knower, or the feeler, or the thinker, or the seer. Right? So I always give a name to myself. You know, I just take myself for granted, really, in reference to all my experiences. I don't really even think about myself at all. But now we have to start thinking about ourselves so that we can recognize that there are two things immediately present to me. As me, the conscious being that is here, the I, the one that is most dear to me as me, I am here, and all of these objectifiable experiences are here. At the same time, it's not like you are having all of these experiences, all of these thoughts and feelings and moods and perceptions, and you are hidden. You only have the perceptions, but I only have experience of the perceptions, but I have no experience of myself. That would be absolutely weird. You wouldn't be here then. It'd be like you would be some inert thing behind a magic curtain that was devoid of any type of experience. It's not possible. It's not possible because all of these, even in your language, all of these experiences are my experiences. So I am very much present. These experiences, they belong to me. They're my experiences. It's just the problem is that we haven't had a means of knowledge to help me differentiate me from these experiences. See, like, for instance, if I see the wall, or I see all of you, then my mind will say, yes, of course I see all of you, you know. Through my eyes, I'm able to see you. And that it ends there. Of course I'm able to see you, you know. My thoughts, my emotions, of course I'm aware of my emotions. I feel my emotions. But it stops there. I'm the feeler of my emotions. My emotions are known to me. What stops is, who is that me? Who is that me that's illumining, you know, those feelings? Because, yes, the feelings are known to me. But who is the one that the feelings are known to? See what I mean? Who is the one that is there as the self, the conscious being, for whom all of these perceptions are? That's what we have to start looking at, because until we do, your presence is taken for granted, absolutely. It's not that you're not here. You know you're here. The me is always ever present. But you don't need to think about it because you take it for granted. You are ever present to every experience that you have. But so it never occurs until it does. It never occurs to me that I am ever present and the experiences are coming and going. That doesn't occur in my mind until one bright day. It does occur, and that should be a total mind blower. Mm-hmm. Because it's true. The experiences come and go, all of them. except for me, the one for whom these experiences are. I am here for every single experience. We even talk like that. These are my experiences. And so we have to now, and the whole teaching of the Upanishads is this, we have to gain a viveka, a discrimination, in this mix of experiences in which I am the centerpiece of every experience, I am the conscious being there of every experience. I have to be able to recognize myself amidst all of these experiences and then understand the nature of the experiences that I'm having in reference to me. And when that is known, when that is thoroughly known, then this whole thing becomes like a rope snake with a snake remaining. In this way that I see in my experience, it's not that I gain knowledge and the whole universe disappears. I gain knowledge and the whole universe becomes the pot and I become the clay. The clay is my own being, which I recognize as the self of every perception I have. There is no perception. There is no name and form that doesn't have conscious being as itself. That I see clearly. So instead of the subjective rope snake, where the snake disappears and you're just left with the rope, there's no universe. As long as this body, mind, sense organs is here, and you're going through your life from birth to death, when I see clearly what I see looking out at everyone, seeing exactly what everybody else sees, plus something, plus the recognition of the changelessness of my own being, being the very, what we call, adhishtana, the very being which all of these things enjoy. So that being, you can't, sometimes I forget to turn off the, I have to turn off the phone. Okay, 1 minute please. Okay. So the vision is quite a bit different because of the presence of yourself and all of this information has been superimposed on it. Now, removing that self-ignorance, now what I see is same as everybody else sees, but I recognize the pervasiveness like the clay of my being as being the self of all of this. So subjective, the snake goes. Objective, I recognize and see the truth of the subject, means my being, as being the very self of all objects. So myself is the, I recognize as the self of this body, mind, sense organs, but I also recognize my being as the self of all body, mind, sense organs. I'll explain that thoroughly so that you can start to see that it is. But seeing that, the snake has become mitya. Right? Seeing that, the snake becomes mitya. The snake becoming mitya means it's completely not there as any second reality. It's like the pot. You can never say the pot is a second reality. We've got the clay, we've got the pot. No. We have the clay, and we have the mitya pot, right? Which in fact is nothing but clay. We have this universe, which is in fact nothing but my being. Well, Ishwara, the whole creation, is nothing but my being. Or if that makes you scared, you can say like this. You can say this, the whole being, this whole creation enjoys Brahman as itself, the infinite conscious being as itself. So Ishwara's being, Ishwara's self, the Lord's self, is Brahman, is infinite conscious being. And that infinite conscious being is myself. So the self of Ishwara is the very self that abides in all beings. And you can say that feels better, otherwise you feel like an egomaniac. Because you're identified with your own body, mind, sense organs as being yourself. But what you recognize is that this very intimate self that is me, is the very self of Ishwara, that innermost being that is me, right, is really the self, the one non-dual self of Bhagavan. Such a beautiful vision, and your mind feels the sanctity of being in the presence of your own being. That's our time. So that's good. That's it. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Hari Om.